In the age of Zoom interviews, books convey credibility. In fact, libraries are being called on to send out books to fill shelves, but many are already populated with the huge volumes of Robert Caro. He is instant cred. His Pulitzer Prize-winning books on the brilliant but flawed New York builder Robert Moses and lawmaker then President Lyndon Johnson are considered the best in historical biography. The Power Broker about Moses and four books about Johnson with a fifth in the works weigh in at thousands of pages. Robert Caro spent years on each, tracking down families carelessly displaced by a Moses highway or moving his own family to the Texas Hill Country to understand the people Johnson came from. Both of Caro's subjects had power. Robert Caro found out why. Readers can now find out how he did that. In 2019, he published the slim, beautiful book Working, about how he researches, interviews, and writes. And Robert Caro joins us now on Skype. Welcome.
Nice to be here on Skype.
What did you think with your books showing up on those Zoom interviews?
To tell you the truth, that was sort of startling and humbling. My wife, Ina, noticed that. She said, the power broker's behind everybody's head. So you feel good about it, you know, because that book came out 46 years ago. And to see the young political reporters using it now, that's sort of, to be honest with you, thrilling to me.
Well, and I was also thinking about the years you spent writing the book on Robert Moses, the man who ruled New York, building all the bridges, the parks, Jones Beach out on Long Island. He was like God, you know, he created New York in, you know, however many years. But you also felt insane. You had no money. Your wife, Ina, she's also your research partner, sells your home without telling you just to get cash. What kept you going?
The more I was finding out, the more I said, you know, no one understands how power works. I said, Robert Moses was never elected to anything. He held power for 44 years. How did he get that? I felt it was important to finish the book so that even if I never got to do another one, people would understand how power really works in cities.
And you learn right off the bat, one thing that's precious to the researcher you'd become, files. You're a young reporter at the great late Long Island Newsday. There's a battle over building an airport. You get a call on a Sunday. You're there alone. Someone at the FAA says, I like what your paper's doing. I'm just going to leave a door open and there's going to be some boxes on a table. And there you walk in and you have this treasure trove. Talk about that part of the work, the finding the papers.
Everyone else was at a picnic on Fire Island, so no one had a cell phone then, so I had to go myself. I remember I worked all night. I wrote a memo. Then I went home, and the phone rings, and it's the managing editor's secretary, and he was an old-time newspaper man who always looked me askance because I was from Princeton. His name was Alan Hathaway. She said, Alan wants to see you right away. So I said to my wife, I'm about to be fired.
But instead, he makes you an investigative reporter because of what you found in those files. You tell him, I don't know how to do that. He says, what?
He said, just remember one thing, turn every page. And I've remembered that and sort of tried to follow it all my life.
Well, no kidding. You'd later find Robert Moses papers tucked in a huge building in New York. You'd discover, you know, people making deals. The road gets moved. Moses's Northern Boulevard was supposed to go through this rich guy's private golf course. It juts down 4 miles away to, as you write, protect him from the hoi polloi. It leaves the rich alone and destroys this road, destroys these small farms. Now, you could have just written that. Oh, this road was moved and it went through farms. But you didn't. You went and found the farmers.
That was a moment of awakening for me, Robin. It was the moment that I realized that if I really wanted to write about political power, I would have to write not only about the men who wielded power, who had power, I would have to write also about the powerless, the people who didn't have power and whose lives were affected either for good or for ill. And it came to me when I was interviewing one of these farmers, actually his son and his wife. He had died. And they said, the day Robert Moses took our farm was the day our lives were ruined. When you heard that, you suddenly said, that's an aspect of power, too. What government can do for people and what it does to people.
Yeah. Well, we mentioned you and your wife, Ina, moved to the Hill Country in Texas. to get closer to the people there who were very closed off. You're a New Yorker, and you decide, can anyone tell, that you have to move in and really, with your wife, get to know these women. And it's astonishing what you find out. There was no water, no electricity in this area till Lyndon Johnson brought it. Talk about not just discovering the hardship of these women's lives, but realizing if, you know, maybe their story wasn't going to get told.
The wells in the hill country are about 75 feet deep. That's the water table. And I remember one of these very elderly women saying to me, "You're a city boy." So she went to her garage, and there was her old water bucket with the frayed rope still attached. She took me over to the well that was covered with boards. She pushed the boards off, and she dropped the bucket into the well. She said, "Now pull it up." And let me tell you, it was heavy. And there was this heavy bar of wood, like cattle wear, like cows wear. And she said, "We put this on so we could carry buckets at a time." And then you know, I was from New York. And one thing I had noticed was the women of the hill country seemed to me to be much more stooped than city women. Mm. And I learned that their expression was bent. We got bent early. This one woman said to me, "I swore I wasn't going to be bent like my mother. But as soon as my kids started to come and I had to carry the water, I knew I would look exactly like my mother looked." Mm. So Lyndon Johnson is a political genius. He's running for Congress, and he finds the magic line. He says, "If you elect me, I'll bring electricity to this country, and you won't look like your mother looks." And it seemed impossible. There was no dam. There was no source of water power or any other power for electricity. A dam had been started on a river at the edge of it, but it was the Depression. The dam had stopped. And if they built the dam, how were they going to lay lines, thousands, tens of thousands of miles of lines across these empty hills to connect these scattered farms? But he persuaded the president, Franklin Roosevelt, to do it. And that was his first great achievement.
Robert Caro, you say you wanted people, readers, to see the epic, the grandeur, the majesty in the story you're telling. And by that, you meant, obviously, these people, these, you know, not just the power brokers, but the ones affected by them, but also the power brokers. You know, Moses, he built the bridges that make New York look like a Christmas tree at night. He built the parks. He did these great things, but then terrible flaw, brutal to people who got in his way. Johnson, you just described what he did for the people of the Hill Country. He also rammed through civil rights legislation, but then fell because of his escalation of the Vietnam War. In places in the book, Working, you say how you when you think of each of them at certain times, you could just cry. How do you feel about these two men?
Oh, it's very, these are terrific questions. Mixed, well, you know. You take Lyndon Johnson, so now it's the last book in my series on Johnson. So, of course, Vietnam is a major part of it, and that's a tragedy. But you think also, Johnson had a compassion for people and a genius for turning that compassion into government action. You know, Jack Kennedy is assassinated. 4 days later, Johnson has to make his first speech to a joint session of Congress. He's still living in his home, and down in the kitchen, four of his aides and speechwriters are around this kitchen table writing the speech. And they said, "Well, we're really not ready yet, but there's one thing we all agree on. Don't make civil rights a priority. If you do, you're going to antagonize the Southerners who control Congress. They're going to stop your legislative program, just like they stopped Kennedy. Don't do it." And Johnson says to them, "Well, what the hell's the presidency for then?" And he goes out and he makes his first speech and he says, "My first priority is to pass Jack Kennedy's civil rights bill." And as he's saying it, he's saying it to this row of Southern senators sitting right in front of him. His fight for civil rights and voting rights is epic. It's an epic of triumph of what government can do, just as Vietnam is an epic of tragedy.
Hmm. Robert Caro, I'm thinking of some of the tips that you give, and I'm going to abide by one. You say that when you're doing an interview, silence is a weapon, and you constantly write, as you're taking your deep notes, you constantly write the letters S-U, What does that mean?
It means shut up. I talk too much. So I learned that if you could just not talk, you ask a question and the guy doesn't want to answer it. One of the best things I found that I can do is not say the next line. You know, there's a silence and we're all human. We feel we want to fill it up. But if you don't fill it up, often they'll fill it up. And they'll fill it up with something they wouldn't otherwise have said. So, yeah, if you look through my notebooks, Robin, you'd see an awful lot of SUs written there.
I'm writing one to myself right now. Robert Carroll, again, his latest book is Working, Researching, Interviewing, Writing. It's a must read for anyone who wants to attempt to do any of those things and also has read his great volumes. He's been called the greatest political biographer of our times. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.